Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara,
and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Skype music.
Yes, good morning, Grant speaking.
Grant Newsham, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, retired, joins us now from, where in the world are you, Waldo?
Oh, I'm just in Hawaii.
Now, that's relatively boring. When are you going to go to a more exotic place?
Later today.
Oh, really?
I'm just going to Japan.
All right. So where in Japan?
Oh, just Tokyo.
Just Tokyo. Mm-hmm. Do you like, are you fond of Tokyo?
Yeah, you know, it's okay. It's like anywhere you've lived for 20 years. You know, it's no longer exotic, but it's comfortable. But, you know, I'd probably rather go to Bermuda or Zurich or somewhere like that, but somewhere different. But it's okay. Yeah.
Now,
it's not like thinking, you know, you have to go to Indianapolis.
Do you have any issues because you've written about the Japanese mafia and things like that? Did they ever come like leaving dead fish on your hotel door or anything like that?
You know, I don't think they really care that much. I probably have more issues with, say, Japanese police or Japanese authorities, because they're very resentful of people who criticize them. And implicitly and explicitly what I say is that the Japanese police and financial regulators and politicians all have deep ties with the Yakuza. So they're more likely to take offense than the Yakuza are. So it's not, you know, human nature is what it is, so it's, one knows how bureaucrats don't like to be criticized, even if it's true.
Which is, you have to love the world that they live in. So I'm curious. I'm not Japan bashing here, but most people, you know, we look around the world as Americans, and we kind of have this American. We view everything from the lens of the American experience. So we think everybody's been through the same experiences that we have. The Japanese are an island nation, a single race nation. They, I don't think, describe themselves as a melting pot, as we do here. Where is Japan, just so the rest of us know, relative to civil rights, equality, being accepted if you're not from there? Is it still a pretty tough? I imagine it's better than it used to be. But, for instance, things like interracial marriage and things like that, that the fastest growing segment I read in the census is people that claim interracial heritage as their origin. So, I'm curious your assessment, Grant. When I was there, it was not the most open and accepting place. It was downright difficult. How is it better today? Is it still pretty close to what it used to be?
I think it's better by quite a bit, particularly compared, say, to 25, 30 years ago when foreign things and foreign people were considered strange, or more strange. But over time, there's just a lot more foreigners around. There's a lot of foreigners who speak Japanese. You know, different generations come along, maybe almost two of them. And it is very different that you could go there. You would, you know, a foreigner would fit right in. It wouldn't really feel anything amiss. They might have trouble renting an apartment until they found a landlord that was willing to rent to a foreigner. But you can always find something. It's really not all that bad. And though I would say that's from the perspective of an American or a sort of really a white person. Southeast Asians, other Asians tend to have generally different experiences. But once again, it's not all that, you know, it's not all that bad. You know, I would suggest that if I say I packed up and moved to Southwest Virginia, I have a feeling that I would have just as hard a time breaking in to the local society beyond a superficial level as I would, you know, say in Japan. There's a, maybe people are pretty tribal once you scratch the surface a little bit. But Japan's gotten a lot better in that regard. It seems to be sort of an article that all foreign reporters write once during their tour now about how, you know, the Japanese are anti-foreign, this and that. But, you know, I'm not so
well,
sure.
Well, I think you make the point that when you compare them to Southwestern Virginia, that's not exactly what we would like to say is progress.
No, it's, well, you know, I would have to say, you know, it is. It's a feeling, like, you know, I get from having, you know, been there for so long.
Mm-hmm.
But I say to really get into the society, you know, to have, you know, to just be taken as a complete Japanese person, a complete local, you know, maybe you'd say it's not, that's hard. And I would say that that's kind of hard everywhere. You know, Buffalo, New York, Southwest Virginia, you know, it's just hard to get fully taken in, as somebody from there. But you can, once again, you'll, you know, have people you get along very well with, and, you know, your daily dealings with people, with shopkeepers, officials, and it's not, you know, it's not going to make you feel bad. Though every now and then you will have an experience that does make you feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
Say, for example, I get stopped all the time by the police to check my bicycle to make sure that I haven't stolen it. So you'll have these experiences, but by and large, it isn't like it used to be, you know, where a foreigner could actually kind of get stared at in some places, or a foreigner could speak Japanese, and the particularly older Japanese people simply couldn't understand it. Because it didn't compute, you know, Japanese coming out of a foreigner's mouth. You don't have so much of that anymore. At least in my experience, if you go to the real rural areas, you may have it maybe a bit different. But certainly in Tokyo and the bigger cities, the idea that foreigners just aren't as unusual as they used to be. You know, for example, there used to be, there were a handful of white people, Americans mostly, who made very handsome careers on Japanese television because they could speak Japanese. It was the oddity of it all. That's because they were some of the very few Westerners who could speak Japanese well. Now those people are a dime a dozen. So it just has changed over time. And say if you went, you would not feel, you know, like you were a, sort of an alien from outer space anymore. But like a lot of things, everybody has their own experience. And as I said, it just takes one bad experience to really make you think differently. And if I've been around the place for 25, 30 years, and as I say, every time the cops stop me on my bicycle, I am just incandescent with my disgust for these people. And then you get over it. But that would be, you know, like going, I don't know, to the Baltimore. In fact, I would say...
Let's not talk about Baltimore, okay?
You see my point. Yeah. It's, you know, I would be fit in and be taken much more sort of as a member of the group in Japan than I would if I went to parts of Baltimore. So like a lot of things, it depends on how you think of it. But it, you know, like a... And, Japan is a big place, so almost anything you say about it can be true. You know, for example, if you take these old politicians who sit in the Diet, all of whom look like Yakuza bosses, but aren't as smart, if you asked any of them what they think of foreigners, they would probably say, oh, kawaii, scary. You know, these guys do think, you know, like people from 80 years ago. But the average Japanese person on the street is much more, you know, with it or you know, has come along in their thinking much, much more than their elected representatives. So you can find, you know, sort of examples of anything, but by, you know, trying to step back to 5,000 feet and generalize a bit, you know, it's really not, it's not that bad.
It's not the way I'm thinking of it. Well, because see, when I close my eyes and I remember my experiences in Korea, on the Korean Peninsula and in Japan, they're very gracious, you know, to us. But I remember a conversation I had with a Korean company commander, Captain Park, and my platoon, because I was a locked on second lieutenant. My platoon got sent to his company to train with them, and they sent a Korean platoon to send to my company in this kind of flip-flop as we trained together. And, you know, only the sharpest lieutenants got sent for that kind of stuff, right? I was being an ambassador for my country for the first time. So we're standing there, and you know, my platoon's getting ready to do whatever we're doing with them. And so it's like all the platoon commanders are standing there with him, and he's telling us what's going to happen. He's telling them what they're going to do. Then he speaks to me in English. And okay. And then he looks at me as he's smoking a cigarette, and he looks at me, and he says, Lieutenant McNamara, do you believe that, and he uses the N-word, are your equal? Now, about a third of my platoon was black, right? And they were out of earshot. And my head snapped, and I looked at him, and I said, absolutely, sir. And I'm a second lieutenant, so I didn't feel like I should correct him, right, in front of other officers. So I thought I would be gracious. I said, well, sir, the whole premise of my nation is that everybody's created equal. And we're all equal. And in our history, it hasn't always been that way, but is that what we are? Is that what we should be? Yes. And then he looks at me, and he uses the word again. He said, well, many Koreans do not believe that they are equal. They believe they're animals. In fact, they believe they have tails. And I said, sir, if you use that word in my presence one more time, I'm going to take my platoon, and I'm going back to my company. And with that, he looked at me, and he said, you know, two black soldiers raped a Korean girl last year. It is a very big deal in my country. And I said, who committed the rest of the rapes in Korea? I imagine, sir, that wasn't the only rape. Who committed the rest of the rapes in Korea last year? Korean men? I said, so I'm not sure I understand your point. And then he looked at me and he said, you have a very smart mouth, Lieutenant. I said, I don't know what I said. I very diplomatic, because I was being an ambassador, I diplomatically got out of it. But you know, to me, that's an unvarnished look of, you know, of the working class and how they view a multicultural society. And you know how we rolled around the world, sir. I mean, everybody, Asians, Hispanics, blacks, every color under the rainbow comes rolling in with an American unit. And it's not the way that other countries do it. And so I don't, you know, I whether I'm too jaundiced by that experience, and then not being able to go into certain clubs in Japan when I was drunk late at night bothered me as well. You know, as you're attempting to walk in, and the bouncer says, sorry, it's full. And then Japanese people go streaming by you. And you're like, wait a minute. They went in. Why can't we? And they're like, it's full to you. It's not full to them. And they tell you to get out of there. They were going to call the Japanese police, and you could deal with the Japanese police, which nobody ever wanted to do. And so would I still find those experiences today, or are they fundamentally different?
You could find some of them. The, you know, if you don't go to the club area, you're not going to have that problem. No, but you wouldn't have enough, or you shouldn't have enough to shape your opinions.
Okay.
The entire place. Whereas in the past, you might have. I think it really has changed, you know, just as say thinking back 25, 30 years, that it, you know, that sort of the fear or the sort of puzzlement over foreigners isn't, it's not what it was. I think that's a natural thing. But at the same time, what you've described about these sort of tribal attitudes towards all foreigners, and even within Japan, you have, say, Southerners from Kagoshima don't like to hear, say, the voice of Northerners, or guys from Tokyo. There's still a lot of tribal, just region, domestic tribalism within Japan. It's there. Just as, say, a Yankee in the South might be regarded, or vice versa. So it is there. It is tribal. And as you pointed out, we are, there's never been anything like the United States, where it's based on an idea, not on race or religion. And it's anyone who comes here and wants to be an American, and with all that involves, is kind of welcome and can get farther into society, can be treated like a real native, a member of the tribe, more than any country on earth, I would say, maybe that's ever existed.
Well, but I don't know that we really understand that until you go to another country, right? And you kind of, and you look and you say, you know, this is an island nation. It is, you know, they may have brought other people here as laborers, right? But in terms of the nation is Japanese. And, you know, the identity is Japanese. It is not, there is no Statue of Liberty with, give me your huddled masses, I lift the golden lamp. there isn't that. You have a place in Japan because we have a, so it's, I don't think you really appreciate the multicultural country that you do come from until you go someplace else and you see that it's not that way. You know, and you can go to a country and you can be a laborer and you can build stuff, but you certainly won't be accepted. And so I think it is the beginning of understanding what a unique experiment that the United States has been and throughout its history. And again, you know, I would say this, that I've thought about the experiences that I had. It would be certainly atypical to grow up in a single race country, hearing the things that you would hear, and then be completely open to experiencing foreigners and treat them as equals. I mean that's a decades long march, as we've certainly seen in our own country, to equality and acceptance. So anyway, so interesting to hear your thoughts on the. A lot of stuff gone on in the Western Pacific since last time we talked to you. Secretary of Defense went to visit China, but there wasn't a whole lot of news that came out of it. He's been relatively muted in what he said about his trip. There are people that quoted President Xi as saying that in their conversations that China has absolute rights to the South China Sea. So I'm curious what your read is on all that. What was accomplished? And then we saw what, within the last 48, 72 hours, two American warships, for the first time in a year, have sailed through the Formosa Straits, which seems to be a little bit of a – and they could have been scheduled for a long time. I haven't looked at the operational calendar for the Seventh Fleet. And their Freedom of Navigation Acts. So your thoughts on that trip and what little has been said on the backside of it?
Yeah, just my impression was that General Mattis went to China and really just laid out the American position on a number of issues. And I don't know what – I have a feeling they – we're pretty sure the Chinese were not going to say, oh, yeah, thanks for telling us. Now we understand we were mistaken. But and if that's what they expected, they would have been surprised. But I don't think they did. So what the Chinese did is laid out their position. And as Xi said, well, we won't give an inch in the South China Sea. That would offend our ancestors, even though their ancestors barely even knew where the South China Sea was. But so China, as expected, did not, say, give an inch. but the Americans didn't either, which is a good thing. As near as I can tell, General Mattis laid out the position. In the past, the Americans would have just worried to no end about what they could do to not make the Chinese angry. They would not have mentioned things. They would have placated the Chinese, but Mattis came and just said, this is our position, this is what it is. And then was followed up, of course, with these two ships going through the Taiwan Straits, which I don't think was a coincidence in terms of timing. It took place during the RIMPAC exercise when the Chinese were disinvited, were told you're not welcome, and also took place just as the U.S. imposed trade sanctions were kicking in against China. So I don't think any of this is coincidence. I think this is some concrete sort of activity to demonstrate that America will look after its position, look after its interests in Asia. And you've certainly got a China which is not willing to concede, at least yet. Fortunately, an America that is once again getting up on its hind legs, and that's my sense. It's unfortunate that it's come to this point, because China could have been dissuaded at any time over the last 20, 30 years. But now it's, oddly enough, it's the Trump administration which is finally doing what should have been done a long time ago. But the Mattis visit didn't lessen tensions at all. It didn't resolve anything, but it was a welcome change to have the Americans finally worry more about American interests than about what the Chinese might think about whatever we do, and that has hamstrung us for decades.
So it's pretty impressive when we impress ourselves when we don't go and sell ourselves out. Is that where we're at?
Kind of. I think it discombobulates our chattering class and the reporters who always think there's going to be a story to something. And here they're, to me, that is the story, that we didn't placate the Chinese. And I'll give you a good example of how this has worked in the past, and it's a recent one. After the Permanent Court of Arbitration decision regarding China's South China Sea island building, a couple of years ago during the Obama administration. I mean, right after it. And there was sort of some joy on the parts of the American side, like the part I'm on, that the Americans had this tool, this ruling by the court in The Hague, very well-respected, well-regarded, long-standing court, just completely obliterating the Chinese position. And certainly the Obama administration was going to use this to pressure China to change its behavior for the better, to stop seizing the South China Sea, stop threatening American allies. And so the Obama administration sent, I believe it was the CNO at the time, and also the Susan Rice, I think the National Security Advisor, they sent them to China right after this agreement, this decision by the court was reached. And they went to China, and they did not even mention the PCA ruling. I mean, they didn't even talk about it.
Come on, you're making that up just so I'll think you're cool and funny.
Well, it is something I'd make up, but it is... there's no punchline here. They did mention it.
How can you go? That thing rocks. That thing rocks, and everybody has this aha moment when it's done. And we go there. It's like you can't. How could you actually not talk about it? It would be impossible, wouldn't it, for us to like. So how are things going? What's new? Oh, nothing. Nothing. Just came here.
Well, no, you don't. You lack nuance. I think you don't. You just don't get it. You know, the idea was that if you go there and you don't embarrass the Chinese by mentioning it, they're going to appreciate it so much that this will have a sort of a positive effect on their behavior. Now, sort of if you get invited over to say your friend's house and they've just been convicted of, like, I don't know, armed robbery. And you don't mention it. No, hey, don't mention this because and they might appreciate it.
It might be awkward.
But that's what they did. You know, what do you say? And how well did that work? Just said full steam ahead for the Chinese, and they in short order referred to this ruling as a piece of trash paper. So that's been the usual American MO when dealing with China. Sometimes there's sternly worded letters or expressions of grave concern by, you know, the John Kerry's, the Warren Christophers, and that sort of thing. But finally, you know, Mattis goes, he doesn't placate them, and he tells the Chinese, this is what we think. So you can see what a shock that is. That wasn't picked up on by the media, for whatever reason. But that's how I read the visit. You know, I would have liked the Chinese to surrender, but I suppose I didn't think they were going to do that.
All right. No, I thought it was odd too, you know, and so to me, when you see things that are odd, you know, like people telling the truth in politics, like what did he just say? And that always gets my attention. So when you see two substantial people getting together and they happen to be on sides that don't see eye to eye, and then not too much comes out on the backside of that, that I want to talk about a little bit. So, but you haven't seen so much. There's been other world events that have gone on, but kind of interesting. So you reading the tea leaves that we laid out our positions and for the first time in a long time did not sell ourselves out, which I'm sure the rest of the region took great heart that there was no proclamation coming out of it that we would now accommodate the Chinese. They thought, was there anything written relative to, you know, some of the regional periodicals in Japan and Australia about the meeting?
You know, I haven't seen it in I haven't noticed it. I don't read everything, of course, but I haven't seen that picked up on. But I've got the sense from some of the comments that you hear around the region and what's written that there is a belief that maybe you can count on the Americans. You're not reading people saying, you know, look, the Americans didn't, you know, Americans are provoking the Chinese. This is getting scary. But rather there's a sort of a quiet sense that maybe the Americans are serious and are going to push back. And maybe it's worth sticking with the Americans. Of course, places like Cambodia and Philippines, President Duterte, they are what they are and right. See things differently. But in places like Singapore, Indonesia, Australia, Malaysia as well, and even up in Japan, you know, there's a sense, I think, in certain quarters that matter that the Americans, you know, that they're doing something different and maybe that the sort of Chinese domination of Asia is not a sure thing. But as I say, that hasn't gotten, I haven't seen it written up this way, partly right. Because it's not a hard argument to make, but it's not as exciting a story, and it requires a little context and to make the point, to describe what just happened, because people are usually reporters as well, are used to something that happens that they can point to. And here there wasn't a thing that happened. It was in some ways what didn't happen, but also just the idea of the Americans on their hind legs is such a surprise after successive Democrat and Republican administrations that even I hardly know what to make of it.
That is awesome. America on its hind legs. Who would have thought? The next issue that has obviously taken up much discussion over the weekend, when we're not listening to the Supreme Court, the hysteria that surrounds an appointment of a Supreme Court justice, is what's going on in in North Korea relative to Secretary Pompeo's latest visit. So to me, this is I'll give you my analysis. I won't even charge you for it, and you can let me know what you think. Now it comes down to making sausage, right? We've done all the we've done the opening ceremonies. We've cut the ribbons. The jets have flown over, right? We've said what we said. Now it comes to making sausage, which is not a pretty process. Although I've never actually seen it in person, I've heard that. Secretary Pompeo at the end said we made progress on all fronts, and we have hard work. You know, he said all the right things, but he said we made progress. The North Koreans came out and said the Americans with their gangster like demands, blah 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 blah. What do you make of all of that?
That's a good question. You know, I think as I noted before, I'm cautiously pessimistic.
Right.
Like you. And you know, having, you know, with 25 years of empirical evidence and experience, it's hard to have gotten too optimistic about what's going to happen with North Korea. But as you said, it's, you know, now's the time that we're going to see what can be done. What kind of a deal is possible? My sense is that this is the North Koreans acting the way they always do. This sort of, not just foot dragging, the sort of the use of foul, vulgar language to describe us, whomever, the Japanese. It used to be the South Koreans, but now that they have a South Korean regime that pretty much wants to appease them and sees the Americans as the problem, they're not being so mean or foul-mouthed towards the South Korean. This is pretty much the way they've always done things. You know, if you think back when there's been previous negotiations, you know, there'll be like a day or two when it looks like there's progress made, when it looks like the North Koreans are finally going to cooperate. They want to resolve this. They want to bring their country into the 21st century or 20th century from the 8th century. And, you know, finally things have changed. And then you just wait a day or two, and this exact thing happens. You know, they start calling the counterparts names. They claim that everyone's trying to cheat them, is acting like gangsters. That's a word we've heard before.
Right.
And then the other side starts thinking, well, what can we give them to make the North Koreans happy? How much money? How much food? What can we give them that'll make them change? And it's something that has played out many times before. So we've seen this, and now let's see what the American side, led by Secretary Pompeo, can actually what they do is, and hopefully they will not fall into that past pattern of once again trying to see what the North Koreans want. What is it that'll make them happy? What kind of bribe can we pay them? One curious thing of North Korean behavior is that you'll notice that they've criticized sort of the Americans, but they've said, "But we love Donald Trump," and that's a curious thing. And I'd take a real sort of Korea expert to fully make sense of it, but that's, let's say, it's different. So they're sort of saying, well, there is an American we like, but that may be that they just want to once again have Trump and Mr. Trump and Kim get in the same room and with all the pageantry and the prestige that comes of that. So I'm not sure if that means that they'll make a deal with Mr. Trump or if they just want to play this for the legitimacy that it confers. Hopefully on the American side that there's people who have a better sense of that but are aware to what the fact they've spoken well of the president and not the rest of the Americans. It isn't necessarily a positive thing, but it is something different that needs to be to figure it out and also see where we might go with, you know, and see, as I say, what might happen. But my looking at the broader context in which these negotiations are taking place, it's One, from what I hear and what has been reported, the Chinese have really eased up on whatever sanctions they were doing, which were half-hearted to start with. And so from the Russians as well are offering to help out. And South Korea, one suspects behind the scenes, is offering a nice package of goodies and loot for North Korea. So from a North Korean perspective, that maybe it's just, well, let's see what we can get from the Americans, what we can give them. Let's stretch this out, play it out until see how the next American elections go. And then we can get a real appeaser in office again.
See, that was, I go back to our conversation. When you look at the longer term view of a dictatorship, and if you look at the history of our negotiations with Iran, with China, if China is not giving advice like, okay, now just slow roll this thing, and, Trump is obviously a different administration from those we've dealt with in the past, wait for the next election and just slow roll this thing. And so look into your crystal ball. Do you think the I don't think the Trump administration is going to, in my opinion, I don't think he's going to get played. I think he's going to give him enough rope to hang himself, if you will. And then when he perceives that he's being played, you're going to see an increase in sanctions, and you're going to see us go revisit going back down that road again. Do you think I'm right? Do you think I'm wrong? I tend to be right most of the time.
No, except when you're wrong. You were mistaken once, but you were mistaken about that. But the I'm with you. I think this is if there's ever been an administration that I can remember that is not likely to go down the road we've always gone down, this is it. And I don't think they will get played indefinitely. We saw that when they canceled the summit in Singapore, and then the North Koreans came scurrying back. I don't think this is going to go on for forever. Or even to the end of this administration. I think there's very much a timeline. I don't know what it is, but I don't think that 2 years from now we're going to be wondering why things are dragging on.
Right.
I don't even think a year from now we're going to be wondering why. This is, I think a good faith effort on the U.S. side to see if this can be resolved without force. Hopefully that the other side and the Chinese in particular recognize this. I'm not sure they do. They've gotten so used to the way the Americans act. But what to watch out for from my perspective is that if things don't move along, it will be a key that the Americans put real sanctions on Chinese entities and entities that matter, not these little trading companies up near the border, but on about four main Chinese banks that facilitate that keep North Korea alive and keep the financial flows going. I mean, put just crushing sanctions on these banks. But if you don't put the sanctions on the Chinese, on China, you're really not going to have any real chance of success. And that's what I think the thing to look for, if, as I say, progress doesn't seem to be made. But this, as noted, this is not going to go on like indefinitely. To my way of thinking, but it's something I think the administration has to do. They were sort of put into this position by the South Korean administration where the Americans could not say, we're not going to talk to these evil people. They either were going to apply pressure, they either do what we say or else and stop threatening us and our friends, or we're going to do something about it. But around the time of the Olympics, with this South Korean, I would call it whatever it is, placating or just rear end kissing policy that they put in towards North Korea, they put the Americans in a position where they couldn't, where they kind of had to go along. Well, now they're going along, and I think if it doesn't pay off or pan out quickly enough, I think we could be back to this very strict sanctions. ideally opposed against China, and we're going to be talking about military force as well to resolve this problem. But the administration, the Americans can now say, we tried, and it didn't work. But that would be just a guess here. That I have a feeling we might.
I like. I'll tell you what. I think you're right. I think we will go back to the implementation of tighter and I believe it'll be sanctions, and then ultimately is blockading a nation an act of war?
Depends on like any lawyer.
Depends on what your definition of is.
You can find some. You can make a case either way you want, but certainly interdictions at sea. You'll notice the Japanese, who are very good with maritime surveillance, have been reporting with pictures instances of ships, North Korean ships, tied up next to what are, I believe, Chinese ships transferring oil. And the Japanese surveillance aircraft, they get very good pictures of it, and the Japanese report it. This is just what they're reporting.
Right.
If you can see it, well, you can sink it. And that's the, you know, one wonders if at some point and suspects it, hopes that at some point we're going to make those ships disappear. That's an option, but it, we'll see, you know, but it is a, one, say one always wants to be optimistic about maybe this time we can resolve something. North Korea wants to change. They want to be a more modern place. But once again, you go back to the nature of the Kim family regime. And this is the, you know, the Gotti family, or this is the Italian mafia. And they don't just one day think, you know, we're tired of being the Italian mafia. You know, we're going to be like really nice people. It's kind of hard to change. So I'm not entirely sure how that's going to come about. I think the administration's doing its best to try to resolve things more easily. But once again, it's just hard to be too optimistic about where this is headed. But at the same time, I'm not, you know, privy to what's going on inside the administration and with these negotiations. And, you know, I'm still inclined to give some time and see what Secretary Pompeo and the others might be able to come up with. And at least then we'll be able to say, well, we tried.
I think in terms of being cautiously pessimistic, that ultimately may be, and I said, we've talked about this before, but if you're going to go to war, you do, in my opinion, as the father of two infantry officers that are serving today, you do have to go down that rabbit hole. Because, you know, to go to war or to risk war, and not to have done these things to me I'll use the word immoral. You have to exhaust all lesser means, and I think this is certainly one of them. But like you, cautiously pessimistic. I want to believe that Lucy's not going to pull the football this time, but she's pulled it every other time, and so I'm an optimist by nature, but you know, we're seeing at some point we're seeing the same stuff. So I guess we'll see. Making sausage is email. Hey, Mac, question. I know that Grant has talked about closing gulags and return of remains and things like this before as concrete steps to demonstrate that North Korea is serious. None of that stuff has happened. I would have thought that the symbolic return of remains would have been both easy and a first step. That has yet to happen. What does Grant see as a first step that the North Koreans would be willing to take? What would he look for? Interesting question. That they would be willing to take. The gulag thing they won't be willing to do, because it's how they do business, I think. So what would be a first step that they would be willing to take, Grant?
Well, that's a good question. They, you know, one with a few things. With the return of remains, I've never been all that impressed with that. I think that's, you know, they've got a warehouse of them that they can dole out for whatever the cost is, $1 million a piece or whatever. They can do that anytime they want. I think the North Vietnamese used to do something like that. But so to me, that isn't a sign of good faith. Or that'd be like the Chinese releasing a human rights lawyer from prison.
Right.
They've been doing that forever and thinking that it placates the Westerners, the Americans. So that one I'm not too, to me, that doesn't impress me so much. I think the Gulag closed some of them, at least. It's, you know, that's going to be obvious that you you can, if that happens, because you can kind of see it. To me, that is not an unrealistic demand.
It's not. To me, it sounds unrealistic. It's like going and talking about human rights in a country that's a dictatorship. Well, you're talking about them compromising their very existence. And so what we would say is, oh, no, you can just do this. What they look at it and say, no, we can't do that. That coercive element is a huge part of the way we rule this country. You're talking about us becoming Muammar Gaddafi, and we're not willing to do that.
You know, I think that, I understand that position, and also I understand the argument why you don't raise it as your first requirement. I'd be inclined to do it myself.
If you were Kim, you would do that?
Not if I was Kim, but if I was the Americans.
You would raise it.
That would be the thing that they've got to do. And it's hard to, you know, if you look at this chattering class that despises Mr. Trump and then part of it despises America, and it is American chattering class, how do you criticize somebody for demanding that kind of human rights, close down the concentration camps? It's a good position to be in if you're us. If you're the person making that argument, but once again, I understand that how it can be couched in both directions. But maybe something, because everything about this regime is illegal. Everything they do is illegal, and I would say if they were to pack up, say, move all their artillery pieces from the heights above Seoul. Move it all up to the Chinese border, then I'd be impressed. You know, and that's something they could do in a show of good faith. I'd just really move out, if not all of it, like 80% of it, just get up and move it out of range. And that, I think, is something they could do that would get our impression, that would make a good impression. But you can always move it back, I suppose, although it's in danger en route, but otherwise, you know, to get them to say, okay, well, we're going to stop counterfeiting, we're going to stop manufacturing. Well, the Chinese do much of the illegal drugs these days, but we're going to get out of the illegal drug business. We're not going to send these slave laborers to blood to the Soviet, to the Russian Far East. We're going to have our fishing boats start pushing Chinese fish or Japanese fishing boats out of their waters. We're going to behave like civilized people. In other words, it's hard to see them doing that. Or why should we say? Boy,
so which would be easier, Grant? Would it be easier for them to do one of those things, or would it be easier to close a gulag, transfer the operations to someplace else, and continue business as normal? I my own opinion would be easier to close a gulag.
I think so. Right. That would be, if you think it through, in terms of what is it that they can do that sensible people would actually consider a concession or an improvement. But closing the gulags is a much easier thing to do. You know, it's not as if you open them up and sent people on their way, that they would suddenly go home, get the rifle over the fireplace, and go to Pyongyang and shoot Kim. It's an extremely repressive society that doesn't really state it well enough. That even if you did release those people, let them go to Sabo, let them go somewhere. That, you could actually say, okay, we'll do it, and we'll send them to South Korea, or let them go to China. and then put those countries in the position of not taking them. You know, I think that's the way, remember, Castro sent 100,000 of his criminals during the Mario Botla when Jimmy Carter was president, gave Bill Clinton his experience as military experience as commander of the Arkansas National Guard.
There you go.
Or so he argued when he was running for president. But so you can get rid of these people and if you're that worried about them, but it's, once again, it's not the kind of place where, they're going to go home and overthrow the regime, I don't think. So, thinking through this, actually, that does seem to be the easiest thing that they might do that is actually taken seriously.
Here's another email. Mac, I'm curious about Grant's thoughts about something he just said, moving the conventional threat away from the DMZ. Is that too hard? I imagine a lot of that stuff is in caves and it's pretty hardened. I also imagine that they could, without too much effort, put a lot of that stuff on trucks and truck it further north. I think that would be a good step because that is the conventional threat that doubles because of its size as a nuclear threat because there's simply so much of it. Is that too hard to do? You raised the subject. It's pretty interesting. That to me is a little bit of genius on the North Korean side, right? We're going to have such a substantial ability to threaten the South Korean capital. While we may not have a nuclear weapon, our conventional blast will rival that of a nuclear weapon. Certainly be the equal of a low-order nuclear weapon fired into Seoul. And that's how we will maintain, that's what we will guarantee our own freedom. Backing that away, is that too much to ask?
I don't think it is. To me, I'm sure there's any number of reasons people could give, and particularly the North Koreans, why they can't do it, it's too hard, or it would be, sort of putting the regime at risk, because the Americans would attack right away if they did that. But the email and the is, there's probably 5,000 intelligence analysts getting paid very well by the United States who write up millions of words on this topic, and the email has actually encapsulated it very nicely, probably in about 75 words at most, and has laid it out very well. That's an excellent comparison that I put straight into the to plagiarize later file is the equivalent of a nuclear weapon that they've got. And it is that, it's been fairly well known, being in artillery range is a trump card the North Koreans have. But once again, it is the sort of the equivalent of having a nuclear weapon that you can get right on target, too. Could they move it out? I think that's doable, like any, just about anything. If they wanted to, they could move all of it or a lot of it out of range. And that would be a show of good faith, but when it's such a wonderful trump card that would be hard. If I was them, I'd open up the gulags first.
Right.
Be my take, but it's the emails is very well taken that that from a North Korean perspective, that's not something they'd really be keen to do, even if they could do it. But I think that is one of the few things that they could do that would actually make a difference or that would impress somebody, because so much of the rest of it is just an agreement to stop criminal behavior that you shouldn't have been doing in the first place.
Here's another interesting email. Mac, in listening to you and Grant, which I enjoy, I would offer this. If I was the Trump administration, you better come across with something. The remains is a joke. That should have already been underway. The gulag thing, that's another joke. We all know that the North Vietnamese did it, transfer them to another place, close one down. Now, I know that's eyewash, but if they're not even willing to supply eyewash, then how much time do you give these jackasses before we tighten sanctions again? And I believe Grant is exactly right. The Chinese, I don't think were ever really into the whole sanctions things to begin with, because they enjoy, much like Russia enjoys Iran being a boil on the United States' ass, China, except to the extent that it impacts them on occasion, loves North Korea running around acting stupid. So if they can't do the most basic of cosmetic steps, I would not entertain this for long. I would simply go back, call it a grand effort, but a failed effort, and go back to the way it was until we hurt them bad enough that they're willing to begin to do these things without another grand meeting plan. That's what I would call progress. But I see this as all a big dance, North Korea doing exactly the things that Grant has said when he's been on the program before, and nothing happening. I hope we don't dance with them for very long. So, interesting. If you can't do the eyewash, Grant, then my own opinion is you're pretty much not very serious. I don't know about you.
Well, that's kind of what most of us would think. You know, if we went and tried to buy a car and we kept getting the runaround, and we wouldn't, like, wait for 5 years until...
We got a new dealer owner in.
Yeah,
come back.
If I were to throw out a time frame, I would be inclined to maybe give this 6 months, maybe 9 months. I'd say after a few months, maybe start pointing out it's not working very well. After 6 months, really start saying this isn't going to work, and then 9 months, call it off. And others might even say do it a lot faster.
Right.
I tend to be kind of slow at a lot of things, so maybe faster would be better.
Right. No, you know, look, when you're talking about the road you're going to go down is the road to confrontation.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be a Middle Eastern type of confrontation where you're talking about low intensity conflict and maybe an insurgency. You were talking about a high intensity conflict that now destabilized the Western Pacific. And you're going to talk about thousands and thousands and thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of casualties. So you better do it the right way. You better be right. And so I would agree with you. I would give them all the time. You know, I'd give them a year to wrap the rope around their neck before I began to re-exert pressure. And I would warn them, hey, you have 90 days before I end this. The ball is completely in your court, and we're looking for eyewash, so that we can sustain this for another 90 days. But without any eyewash, then my eyes are hurt, and I'm going to go rub them and get my own eyewash and blah, 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 blah. So I am interesting, though. Interesting in terms of I think it's coming back to you being right about cautiously pessimistic.
One other thing that's interesting, it's worth remembering in all of this, is that for years, the Chinese have been claiming that they have no influence over North Korea.
Right.
And they say they'll say, well, you don't understand. We have no more influence than you do. And therefore, America and North Korea, you have to talk directly. Okay, now that's what the Americans are doing, talking directly with North Korea. You will notice how the Chinese have injected themselves into this. In a spoiler role, I think they deserve a lot of credit for having ensured that it's gone. No, it hasn't been. They've really interrupted things, and I think influenced Kim erroneously. But you'll see that they were lying the whole time.
Right.
It's what they do, and nobody has really called them on this. So once again, it'd be nice if the media would offer some context.
Oh, are you kidding me?
Or the commentators would offer some context, but remember all those years the Chinese said this, and on the American side, there was the nuanced pedigreed class was telling us, well, you know, they were parroting that. Well, the Chinese don't have any more, don't really have any influence over the North Koreans. And now that there is the, and now we're seeing that they have all the influence. You know, finally, why did it take 25 years to get to this point? I don't know.
All right, sir. First of all, thank you for your time. And we'll talk to you again here in the not-too-distant future. And enjoy your trip to Tokyo. And what's the next piece that we're going to see from you?
Oh, I don't know. I had to do something else for the last couple of weeks, which kind of slowed me down a bit. I think it's going to be an article about U.S. businesses, how they've done business in China, towards China, which over the last 35 years, which resembles battered wife syndrome. That's my point, because it's and it's going to close, I think, with the line, come on, get some respect, guys. Get some self-respect. Because it really has been American business, Western business, acting like battered wives and the way they've been treated by the Chinese and blaming it on themselves. So that's what comes of an MBA and an Ivy League degree, I think.
Wow.
Something like that. You can see I'm full of resentment at 5 a.m. in the morning. I'll probably burn it off.
Have a cup of coffee and join the rest of humanity, Grant.
Okay, I will. But I'll write something nicer probably once I cheer up by 11 o'clock.
All right. First of all, have a great day. Is Hawaii the 49th or the 50th state?
The last one, 50th.
In the 50th state. All right. Travel safe. Thanks, Grant.
Okay, righto. Bye-bye.
There you have it. Grant Newsham here on a Monday edition of All Marin Radio. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. What would you do if you were North Korea and you put yourself in that? And then if you're the United States, how long do you allow it to go sideways before you take it down that road? And then you if you take it down that road again, are you going to stop when they give you X number of sets of remains? Okay, now we'll stand it down again. So to me, that's the challenge of the Korean crisis, is when you go back down that road again, it's going to have to have certain milestones. The only way we're going to shut it off is we're not, you know, look, we want our remains back, right? We want you to pull back conventional weapons from the demilitarized zone. We want you to completely denuclearize the peninsula. Okay? And so it's now going to take these steps. And they're not going to be novice steps, and they're not going to be eyewash. Because when we turn these things back on, we're not turning them back off for nothing. So, the Gunner going to join us next, so don't touch that dial.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.